Moses lived about 1,500 years before Jesus Christ was born. He was challenged with a tremendous responsibility. He'd been living the life of a shepherd. God called him to lead his people out of Egyptian bondage, to be his special nation. Understand that these people that he was to lead had to be convinced of the God that he served, that he was the one who was leading them out, and that Moses was their prophet. For several hundred years, they had been surrounded by idolatry and ignorance. And their minds were clouded by these things. You imagine the young people who had been born during that period and not known the fathers of ages past. And Moses now has the challenge of taking these people from those surroundings and that darkness and that ignorance and making them a nation for God. Where does he begin? Well, you know where he begins. With the book of Genesis. The book, as you know, is titled Beginnings. And indeed, it is the foundation of right thinking. And it's impressive. We can only look at some of those things in our lesson tonight, but I want to do that. And then in some future lessons, some other things that he laid down as fundamental to this nation being able to come out of darkness into the light of truth and to serve the living God. As you open your Bible to Genesis chapter 1, so Moses is going to write this letter. He's an educated man. We believe he was also empowered by the Holy Spirit to write what he wrote. So what is he going to do? The first thing he writes is, "In the beginning, God." But it's interesting, he doesn't say, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," and leave it there. As you continue to read through this first chapter, you cannot help but be impressed with how many times he talks about God. You see this again in verse 3, and verse 5, and verse 6, and verse 7, and verse 8, and so forth. Throughout the first chapter, over and over and over again, he talks about God. In fact, in the first two chapters, God occurs some 46 times. Certainly, that was designed to cause their focus to be on not Moses, but God. And that's the fundamental concept in right thinking. You'll note also that as he writes about God, the way he presents him is a being of infinite power and wisdom. You see, as you read this simple account, it's not philosophical. It's not designed to be hard. It's designed where people of his day, when it was read in their hearing, I don't even know how educated they were, but it would be read in their hearing, that if they just listened to the words of what Moses wrote, they could not help but be impressed if they thought he was a prophet of God. And he gave demonstration of that by the deliverance of Israel from Egypt by the plagues. And so you start here in chapter 1 and verse 3, God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. No scientific explanation, no words that get into things that people can't understand. It simply says, God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. He adds in verse 5, this happened in one day. He said, "There was evening and there was morning," one day. God took a world from darkness and ruin and created light in one day. Verse 6, he does it again. Then God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." We see the works of man just to create a lake or to channel water, how much time it takes and effort and planning. But God said, "Let there be an expanse." In verse 8, it says, "There was evening and there was morning a second day." This involved the entire earth and the expanse that God made in the waters. And you go all the way through the chapter, you have the same thing. In verse 9, God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, let the dry land appear." And so that happened. And then there was vegetation. It goes on to talk about the creation of the animal kingdom and finally the creation of man. And then when you get down to verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. If there's any credibility in this account at all, it lays a fundamental concept in the hearts of the people that there is a being that far exceeds any man, any Pharaoh that's ever lived, any power that they should ever fear is this being who created the heavens and the earth as a habitable place for man to live in 6 days. And that's the impression that's left as you just simply read through the chapters. When you get to chapter 2, thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their host. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested from all his work which God had created and made. And certainly the impression is to be left upon these readers, our hearers, that God made the heavens and the earth in 6 days and rested on the seventh day. Later, Moses would write another book, the book of Exodus. And if you look over in Exodus chapter 20, it may be that people think that Moses was writing a fanciful account. There's no indication that he was. In fact, when you get to chapter 2 and verse 4 of Genesis, this is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created as a historical listing. There's no indication this was designed to be a fable or some kind of figurative representation, but these are actual events that happened in those 6 days. Later on, though, in Exodus chapter 20, he's actually giving laws for this nation, and one of those laws has to do with a special day of the week. We know it as the Sabbath day, verse 8 of Exodus chapter 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Which day of the week will be this day of rest? And that's what Sabbath means, the day of rest or cessation from labor. Well, he again begins to explain. And he says in verse 9, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. That's pretty understandable to the people to whom he's writing. They know what 6 days of labor means, and the seventh day is a day of rest. It's the day of the Sabbath. In verse 11, however, he ties that in with his account in Genesis 1 with the little word for. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. The Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So what God are they going to serve? And what day when they rest on the seventh day, on Saturday, a day of cessation, what does it cause them to remember? Brings them back to Genesis chapter 1. This is the foundational concept. And we see that he intended them to understand that the 6 days of creation are just like the 6 days of their labor. What a being it was that could create the heavens and the earth in 6 days. When you look at that Genesis account in Genesis chapter 1, and you look at verse 27, we find the beginning of man. So with Egyptian mythology and idolatry, all kind of concepts about the origin of man, same thing in any idolatrous system. But in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 27, it says, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And then you go to chapter 2, where Moses now comes back and focuses in on that with more detail. And you see in verse 18 that the man was alone, and it was not good for the man to be alone. And God said, I'll make a helper suitable for him. So we find that there's the man who's alone. He needs a companion. God designs and builds what we know is to be a woman. And so she was made by the hand of God for an express purpose of being the companion of man. He brought her to the man. It says in verse 22, and in verse 24 and 25, we see the relationship between them that we know as marriage. And so here in the very beginning, you have a fully functioning man in maturity, a fully functioning woman. They're not some kind of blob, some kind of developing animal. Two people made in the image of God, man being needing this kind of a companion that could not be fulfilled in the animal kingdom, God making a being that was very unique, nothing else in the animal kingdom could fulfill those needs, and that's the woman, and then bring them together in this relationship of marriage. When you read the Genesis account, if there's no preconceived ideas and no one trying to color your thinking, you read it as if this was a an instantaneous thing. What I mean by that, it happened in one day. Amazing that there was no man, then there is man, then that there is woman, and there is marriage. It's all by the hand of this Almighty God. When you get over to your New Testament in Matthew chapter 19, you know the Bible began, Moses began, in the beginning God created. In Matthew chapter 19, you read a remarkable statement by Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ is who he's purported to be in the four Gospels, who he claimed to be, then he was indeed there in creation. We certainly find that in John chapter 1, the first three or four verses. And here Jesus now is speaking, and he said in verse 4, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Note that Jesus goes back to that same statement, and he indicates that from the beginning there was the male and there was the female and there was the relationship of marriage. And so once again you have the idea of a God who is infinite in his wisdom and power, incomprehensible. We cannot understand a God with this kind of mind and power, but that's the God that's presented in the first chapter and second chapter of the book of Genesis. Okay, so that's a fundamental thought, just one, but we're going to work with that one in our lesson tonight. So what? So Moses lived about 1,500 years before Christ. Let's go to Romans chapter 1. The man who wrote this letter lived in the first century. So we're talking 1,500 years later, in a different place than where Moses was. This time dealing, in the first part at least, of this book with a different people, not Israelites, but people of the world in the Empire of Rome. And where is he going to begin? What does he start talking about? You'll see several things as we look at this chapter that will carry you back to Genesis chapter 1 and show the so what of this infinite concept of God, a God of incomprehensible power, wisdom, who is the creator of all things. We start here in verse 18. "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." There's a lot of things that you can call truth, but there's a specific truth that he has in mind in this context, and as you keep reading, you see what it is. "Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." So the truth is that same truth that we read about in Genesis 1, that there is this infinite being. That is, he had no beginning. Moses just opens up in the beginning God. Where did he come from? He didn't come from anywhere. He just always was. And you have this eternal power. What power indeed that could do what we read about in Genesis 1. If he's that kind of being, he has divine nature. He's worthy of man's worship and fear and service. That's the way he's presented in Genesis 1. He's called God. That's that kind of being, a being of divine nature. Now, he says, verse 21, "Though they knew God, they did not honor him as God." So he says, God's angry with man, verse 18. Why? Because man got away from this fundamental concept that's presented in Genesis 1, that there is the God who is the creator of everything. He always was, and man owes him reverence, thanksgiving, and service. He said, Verse 21, they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their speculation and their foolish heart was darkened. We started off talking about a world of darkness and confusion. And so Moses set the foundation to bring them out. But then when people get away from that, where are they headed? Back to darkness and futility. And so he says, professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. You look at idolatry and men worshiping animals and the stars and themselves. It's just absolutely foolish. But that's what happens when men get away from that fundamental concept of this infinite, eternal, powerful being. In the Roman letter, chapter 11, as Paul reaches one of the end of one of his sections, sections 9 through 11, where he talks about how God dealt with the Jewish nation, he breaks forth in a doxology or a praise of God. And he says this in Romans chapter 11 and in verse 36. From him and through him and to him. Note those three things. From him and through him and to him are all things. That's what Genesis 1 says. Now note the next statement in the verse. To him be the glory forever. That's where he started the Roman letter. They failed to give God the glory. And Paul here has now expanded on God's love and plan for redeeming mankind, a marvelous message of grace. To him be the glory forever and ever. And he explains how God used the Jewish nation in chapters 9 through 11 to bring about his purpose. You look again at Psalm 104. Look at Psalm 104. Look at verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. What does bless the Lord mean? He obviously doesn't need anything from me. It's the idea of reverencing and praising God, thanking God. It's an humble recognition of his glory and his honor. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Why? Look, O my Lord, O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty. What splendor and majesty? Go down to verse 5. He established the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass over so that they will not return to cover the earth. And he goes back to God's powerful work, making this earth what it is for man to live upon it. And then you get down to verse 31. Let the glory of the Lord endure forever. Let the Lord be glad in his works. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. So we have our song leaders that get up here and say, turn to page number. And I'm going to refer to some of the songs we sang tonight. Just happen to fit what we're talking about. Why am I going to pick up my book and try to sing, especially if you have a voice like mine that doesn't sound very good? Why are you going to try to sing? Here's the reason you try to sing. Because you believe Genesis 1. That's why. Because you believe Romans 1. Because you believe in this God who's worthy of... Our efforts may be feeble, but he's worthy of the best we can do. So he says, I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. Let my meditation be pleasing to him. As for me, I shall be glad in the Lord. And so this is a fundamental concept that will affect our desire to praise and recognize God, to worship God, even in things like singing his praise. So this fundamental concept that we read in Genesis 1, so what? It immediately sets the proper concept of God, who he is, and why he is worthy of my worship and reverence and fear and service. Well, connected with that, once I understand that about God and that he's the creator, and he made me in his image, it says something about myself. And so you look back at Romans chapter 1 and you see Paul making that very connection. Look at Romans chapter 1 now, and we're going to go down to verse 24. So he started out at verse 18, and he's dealing with God as the eternal creator. But look down at verse 24. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God. Remember, we started back up in verse 18 with truth. What truth? What truth? This is not the truth of the gospel. That's not what's dealing with here. It's the truth about God that's recorded in Genesis 1 and the consequences of that. And so he said, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. So once I understand this kind of God, then it says, my life is to be dedicated to doing His will, not to satisfying my passions. There may be things I want to do. There may be things that bring me pleasure. But if I believe Genesis 1, that I'm made in the image of God, and I'm the product of His hands, my purpose here is to serve that God, not to serve myself. And that concept is critical. Look, Satan knew that, didn't he? What did he tell the woman? What did he tempt the woman with in Genesis chapter 3? Do you remember what he told her? When you eat that tree, what's going to happen? You will be like God. That's a temptation. You'll be like God. We are not God. We are His creation. And we are to serve and worship and bow to His will. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, this concept of God can help us have a balanced view of life. We talked about this in our lesson last Sunday morning, about the things we possess and the opportunities that are given us. In 1 Timothy 6:17, instruct those who are rich in this present world. And most everybody in this audience is rich in this present world. We are a rich people. He says, not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Don't be conceited as if it's by your own wisdom and your own power that you're able to do what you do, accumulate what you've accumulated, enjoy what you enjoy, the sun, the moon, the stars, the blue skies, the air we breathe, family life, those children that are out here. It's all by the power of this God that you read about in Genesis chapter 1. And he says, instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. Well, isn't that what Paul was talking about in Romans 1? Man was made to do that which is good in God's eyes, to do the works that He has for mankind. And then, in verse 19, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. This life is temporary. Marriage is temporary. But God made man with a soul, made in His image, with a future beyond. And it all starts. This concept of life that you read in 1 Timothy 6:17 through 19, a balanced, healthy view of life and the things we own, starts with the concept of God and self that you find in Genesis chapter 1. So in our songbook, get your songbook and turn to page number 407. We sang number 407 in our song singing tonight. How meaningful is that? Well, it depends whether or not we believe Genesis 1. He leadeth me. Oh, blessed thought. Is that a blessed thought to know that the Creator of the universe is the one that leads me and guides me, helps me know how to live with my wife, how to raise my children, how to deal with difficulties in life? Oh, words with heavenly comfort fraught. Whate'er I do, where'er I be, still 'tis God's hand that leadeth me. That song takes on tremendous meaning if we sing that song with the foundational concept of Genesis chapter 1. That God, that Creator God, is the one that leadeth me. Looking back at Romans chapter 1, we said that Genesis 1 and Romans 1 connect. Paul made that connection. He takes these fundamental concepts and applies it now, not to the Israelites back there, but here to the people in the Empire of Rome. Certainly we can see if those fundamental concepts that were written for the Israelites are now being applied to the people who live in the Empire of Rome in the first century, they have application to you and me as we live in the United States of America another 2,000 years later. So you move 1,500 years down the stream of time, Paul is making those same appeals. And now we're 2,000 years later, should we not be building our lives the same way? And so you look back at Romans chapter 1 and verse 28. So we've seen that Paul appeals to this concept of God. He starts out with that. And then that moves on to the concept we have about ourselves and whether or not we should serve ourselves or live to serve others and do the will of God. And then in verse 28, you see it impact my attitude toward my fellow man, how I treat my fellow man. Look, he said, they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. God gave them over to depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. You read about all these things men do to one another by word and by deed, things that are harmful and hateful. Why? The answer is in verse 28. They did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. If you start with this Creator God, and that my obligation is to do His will, not mine, that's going to affect how I think about my fellow man, how I talk about my fellow man, how I treat my fellow man. And so it's a chain of events all starting with this fundamental concept in the beginning, God. In Genesis chapter 1, and verse 26. You remember what it said? God made man in His image. In His image. When you get to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6, after the flood, you remember that man is forbidden to kill his fellow man, even for food. Why? Do you remember the reason? For in the image of God He made man, Genesis 9, 6. Why can't I kill my fellow man? Why must I respect the dignity of human life? There's the answer. Way back in Genesis 1, it's referred to again in Genesis 9. James refers to it in James chapter 3 when he talks about how we use our tongue. This is a fundamental concept. The second greatest commandment we talked about this morning, what is it? Love your neighbor as yourself. Man made in the image of God. Thus, there's a responsibility to my neighbor as to how I treat him. But it all starts with this concept that we see in Genesis chapter 1. Look in Romans 1:32 now. We just see point after point that correlates with Genesis chapter 1. Notice it says in verse 32, although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death. There's some things that if you do, there's a penalty attached. They're wrong. There are right things. There are wrong things. There is a law. Who made the law? That's the God of verse 18, 19, 20, 21 of this chapter. It's the God of Genesis 1 that made the law. That there are some right things, there are some wrong things. What is sin? You know what sin is. Most of you can tell where the verse at in 1 John 3:4. Sin, King James Version, is a transgression of the law. Your version may say sin is lawlessness. That's what sin is. It's not feeling that something's wrong. It's a violation of the law. What law? Who has the right to make a law to tell me what I can and can't do? You're back to Genesis 1. And you see this here in Romans 1. God has an ordinance that those who violate His law are worthy of death. In Psalm 51, we read a song, a poetic piece by a man who's very powerful at this time, very wealthy. He's the king of Israel. But this man had an humble heart, and he recognizes that he had violated a law greater than any law he could make for his kingdom. And that's the law of Almighty God. In Psalm 51 and verse 3, he said, I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only, I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. Had he not sinned against Bathsheba? Yes. Had he not sinned against the nation? Yes. But what he's focusing in on, that's not what makes it sin. What makes it sin is, I've transgressed your laws. What a holy concept. What a fundamental concept. I've sinned against you, O God. This is the king. He's powerful. Nobody tells him what to do except one. That's the God of Genesis 1. And so you see that this concept of sin. Look in your song books. We sang number 500 in our singing tonight. Number 500. How meaningful does this song become if we believe Genesis 1, if we believe Romans 1, that God made laws for mankind to observe? How am I going to know those laws? How do I know what they are? Here's the answer. Give me the Bible. Star of gladness gleaming. Look at the chorus. Give me the Bible, holy message shining. Thy light shall guide me in the narrow way. Precept and promise, law and love combining, till night shall vanish in eternal day. And as I didn't know what Philip was going to lead tonight, I was just thinking about, I knew what I was going to preach about, and I just thought how beautifully that ties in with these fundamental concepts and making a song like this so meaningful. I need the Bible. Why? Because it states before me, explains to me the law of my God, who made me and whom I must serve. Well, then again, you look in Romans chapter 1 once again. We're not through looking in Romans 1. We see its connection with Genesis. Paul states in verse 16 what this book's about. He said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Well, he's going to explain then, beginning in 18, that God is angry with man for violating his law. What are we going to do about that? It's not in chapter 1. It is in chapter 2 that there's a law. In chapter 3, they violated the law. As a result, they come under the condemnation of death that he stated in chapter 2. And then in chapter 3, he talks about a plan God had already in his mind to take care of man's sinful condition. And so here in Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, he said, I want to talk about that good news. That man who in his darkness involved himself in corruption and ignorance, like you read in verse 18 through 32, God had some good news. The plan of redemption through Jesus Christ. And he writes about that for 8 chapters. And showing that man can enjoy salvation by grace through faith in the gospel. Nothing he earns. Nothing he can undo of his past is salvation by grace through faith in the gospel, Romans chapter 5 and verse 1. And that's what he writes about. And so once again, you see that Romans 1 connects with Genesis 1 through 3 and points to the gospel plan of redemption. But Romans 1:16 is not going to mean anything if we don't understand a creator God, to whom we're responsible, and who has made laws. And if we violate his laws, we're worthy of death. It starts there. Romans 1:16. So what? Unless we do, we have these concepts. That's why in verse 18 of Romans 1, he backs up and goes back to pointing out the need for the gospel. And so we sang in our songs tonight, song number 154. Jesus, keep me near the cross. There a precious fountain, free to all, a healing stream, flows from Calvary's mountain. In the cross, be my glory ever. Who cares about the cross? Who cares about the gospel? Here we are, just a few people gathered here tonight. The world today is concerned about football and baseball and sports and fishing and camping or whatever it may be. Who cares about the cross? I'll tell you who cares about the cross. people who believe Genesis 1 and 2 and 3. People who understand there's a God that has laws. People who understand they failed. And God is angry with man for their transgressions. The cross becomes pretty important now. And thus the book of Romans, in its first 8 chapters, he explains salvation by grace through faith, becomes a precious message. Indeed, we can sing, "Keep me near the cross." That's my only hope. That's my comfort. That's my confidence in the face of my guilt, the cross of Jesus Christ. No wonder John 3:16 has become what's called the golden text of the Bible. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And then as you get to the end of chapter 1 of the book of Romans, I've already referred to this verse because it talks about there's an ordinance of God that those who practice such things are worthy of death. They're worthy of death. In the 6th chapter and verse 23, he said the wages of sin is death. When he preached to a heathen audience in Acts chapter 17, he preached the same thing to that audience. He said, God is going to judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he's appointed, having given proof to all men by having raised him from the dead, Acts 17, 30 and 31. That is to say that there is an eternal destiny. There's more to life than being born, living, and dying. There's a judgment coming. We're going to stand before this God of Genesis 1, and we're going to give account. And there's a destiny out there that's before us, depending upon our relationship to this God. And the only way to be found righteous is through that man he raised from the dead, that is Jesus Christ, Acts 17, 30 and 31. Jesus Christ himself talked about that in John chapter 5, verse 28. He said, "Do not marvel at this, an hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and will come forth. Those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, and those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment." You can talk about God, and you can talk about the gospel, and you can talk about going to church, and you can talk about right living, but if it all ends at death and there is no more, so what? You do miss out on the moral benefit of striving to live that way, but then it's over. But what if it's not over? What if there's an eternity? What if there's a judgment? What if we're going to stand before God's Son in judgment? Ah, that makes a difference, doesn't it? And it all begins with this concept of God that we read about back in Genesis chapter 1. In the book of Psalms, in chapter 14, verse 1, a verse that you've probably heard all your life if you've been a Christian for years or grew up going to church, Psalm 14:1, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Now, because they think that way, look what happens. They are corrupt. They've committed abominable deeds. There's no one who does good, etc. There's the consequences of saying, there's no God. But he said, that's so foolish. It's not dealing with reality. And it leads to moral and spiritual depravity and corruption. In contrast to that, look at Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. The people of Isaiah's day were being deceived by idols, building this idol, covering it up with all kind of metals and various things, then bowing down to worship it as if it could save them. And God said, "How foolish you are." And he challenges their rationality even in doing such a thing. And in Isaiah chapter 40, by way of contrast, in Isaiah 40 beginning in verse 12, where is he going to start? To help these people get out of the foolishness of idolatry and ignorance that they've been involved in. I'll tell you what he does. He goes back to the concept of Genesis 1, verse 12. "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and marked off the heavens by the span, and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure, and weighed the mountains in a balance, and the hills in a pair of scales." He said, who did that? Did that idol you build do that? He said, I want to talk to you about a God who did that. What kind of being must he be? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or as his counselor has informed it, you're going to direct your way? You're going to tell God the best way to govern the universe? With whom did he consult? Who gave him understanding? And who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as like a drop in a, from a bucket, and regard as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust, and Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beast enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are nothing before him. They're regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. There's no need to fear the nations about you, Israel. And it's certainly silly to bow down to some idol as if it's going to deliver you. There's a God. He's the creator God of Genesis 1, the God that Moses wrote about. And that's the one you need to place your confidence in. And you get down to verse 26. He said, lift your eyes up on high. This is what we need to do. And hopefully our lesson will remind us. This is nothing new. These are people who profess some kind of faith in God, but we need to be reminded to lift our eyes up on high and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their hosts by number and calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the just that do me escapes the notice of my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youth grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait on the Lord will gain new strength. They'll mount up with wings like eagles. They'll run and not get tired. They'll walk and not become weary. There is nothing you're going to face in life. There's no trial that you can't overcome if you lift up your eyes on high. That's what he's telling Israel. With a confidence about what Moses wrote in Genesis 1, what Paul talked about in Romans 1, the bottom fundamental concept of the entire Bible, there's no trial you'll face, no difficulty, no sickness, no illness, no pain, no responsibility. But you can't rise up like with eagle's wings, and you can be victorious if we believe in the God of Genesis 1. We're going to sing the song that Philip has selected. God waits to receive those who are penitent of heart. And if we can help you, won't you come as we stand and as we sing.